put these little fragments together. Because we're going to take things like from maybe the end of what you've been saying today and put it up front, take some other stuff, move it down, and you know, it'll be woven together to follow the logic of film continuity, not necessarily the logic of the particular discussion we're having today. And then when you have to work in music, and we're going to have to create, let's say, the sounds for the plane and the bombs and all this sort of thing. It's a lot of, you know, technical stuff. But if it's done well, it's very effective, so it's worth the time.
On the music that you were talking about.
That's what I wanted to ask you about at this point. Music that you remember from the period, hearing over the radio, you know, what's going on back home, or things that people would sing. I know we did a lot of singing. You know, there's always somebody who could play guitar or something, and you sing. What songs do you remember?
I'll tell you what.
For this particular time period, and why, maybe. That would be an appropriate question.
There are two songs that were played at Quezon by the Animals. There's a group called the Animals. One was The House of the Rising Sun, and the other one was We've Got to Get Out of This Place. And I'm sure that every guy, there's got to be about 1,300 plus of us that were up there that will remember the day when that damn Obi-Wan, the bird dog, was flying over, and he had his PA system on, you know, and he was trying to get Choi Hoys and everything else like that. Well, he came by, and the CAC units there or whatever, they were putting out PA systems everywhere, all over the mountain, and they started playing this music, and, you know, we didn't know where they were at, where it was coming from. And at first, we didn't know that it was even ours, you know, that was the places that they place these things. And here comes, you know, the Animals singing, you know, We've Got to Get Out of This Place, and which we agreed there. And then they were playing The House of the Rising Sun. And then each time those two songs would be played, they would be preempted by, you know, Choi Hoy material. And one of the biggest things was The Mamas and the Papas. What was it? Dedicated to the one I or what was it? Name? It's, I've got the tape now, and the Little Rascals was grooving. And you can remember the Beatles songs, which songs that were popular at that time, you know, or all through that era. Even Roy Orbison was still big back then, and he's not anymore. I think his boy was killed over there or something. I don't know. Or maybe it was a drug-related thing. I have no idea. The Mamas and the Papas, the Beatles, the Animals, they were all real big then. And, the exact songs and things like that, or some of the Beatles songs.
Well, we've collected some of these. We went back and actually went, wrote to Armed Forces Radio and got a list of the top tunes by month during the war. So we know exactly what's played over Armed Forces Radio. And so all of these people you mentioned, including the songs, specific songs, of course, were popular at that particular time.
Diana Ross and Springfield. You know, all that Motown stuff was really big. I was trying to think of one that they did a remake on it, and it's, you know, it's just as good.
Who did that? The Supremes?
Yeah. Because I remember I like it, and I still like it. I think it's I'll Be There. Remember that one? Remember that? That was a super one. I think in town, every bar that you'd go to in town, you know, they were playing that song, you know, I'll Be There, and all the whole crap, and We Got to Get Out of This Place, what was it? Puff the Magic Dragon was a big one, because I remember that the real Puff the Magic Dragon, we got to see him work out.
Why don't you just describe that?
Jesus, that is incredible. That is really incredible. I saw it work out. in the DMZ area, and that sucker would roll in at caisson. We would see Puff come by at night, and he'd be on a mission, and they'd drop flares, see. And then it would look like the aircraft, you know, in the dusk, just before it gets pitch black out there, you know, the sky's real dark blue, and you'd see Puff cruising along, and it'd just roll over on its side, on its gun side, and it looks like he was pouring hot molten leather, metal out of the side of the ship. And you could see that pink arc finally hitting the ground. And for every one red tracer, there were five hot rounds going in there. And then when we moved into an area up near the DMZ after that, obviously Puff had been there and just cleared this place down. Just, you know, there was a bullet just about every square foot. It just, you know, right through the trees, you know, and that's what caused that splintering effect in those trees and things. Just really, you know, ate it up. You know, and its guns would make that clacking noise, you know, when it started, and then it would just, you know, turn into a humming whir, you know, and it just, you could hear the, you know, electric guns on it and stuff like that. But boy, that was something else. And they'd fire those old guns up, and you could see them at night, and then all of a sudden, once it was dark, you'd look out, and all of a sudden you'd see a red arc on the ground, and then later on, you'd hear the sound of it, you know, because we were a distance away from where they were operating at, and the sound, it took a while for the sound to carry, but the sky would be lit up by this little glow, and then all of a sudden you'd hear, and it just, you know, made a hellacious noise out there too. You wouldn't see the aircraft, you'd never see the aircraft until, you know, it's time to do his thing. It was something else. And then the B-52s.
That's the next thing I wanted to do. B-52 arc light raids were used extensively all through the caisson thing. And really, one thing, you know, maybe the first thing to describe what it looked like, the scene arc light bombing. We have footage of it.
Do you really?
Yeah.
And train bombing?
During the daylight.
Yeah.
And then the other question would be, what it looked like at night or sound like? So how about the daylight? Did you see one during daylight? The B-52 raids, or did you ever walk through an area that had been hit by it?
I've been through an area that's...
Could you describe an area that had been hit by it?
God, nothing. The area looks like nothing. I mean, you know, just dirt holes about 30 foot wide and about 12 foot deep. Just big craters. And, you know, Even the trees are torn up. Generally, from a blast effect, you would have a large pushing, you know, of a tree still partially intact being pushed away. When those 52s came over, it just crunched them, just really crunched them, and you know, completely clear an area, and you could, you know, it would be like a fire break or like a road through a forest. Wherever those bombs fell, that area was cleared. And, you know, there'd be jungle on either side, and you could see the bombing path that the 52s took. And you can see where just each individual bomb landed, too. And, you know, everybody would walk in looking, you know. I think the first thing that would come to anybody's mind was, where could I have been during this that I would have been okay, or that I would have survived it? You know, this is during a mortar attack or an artillery attack. You always walk into the area saying, where could I have been that I would have survived the attack? In a B-52 area that has been bombed, you just look at it and say, there is no way that you could have survived that attack. Because there isn't. There virtually is no way. It just, you know, they have got a tremendous load of firepower. And at night, you don't... It's just death quiet, and all of a sudden the ground starts shaking, and then you start hearing this boom, 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 and you're hearing each one of these old bombs starting to hit, and you know that a B-52 raid's being conducted, but you can feel that, the whole earth, you know, and you,
we were sitting around wondering, you know, I wonder if they can feel this back in the world, because, you know, these are from miles away. They're dropping these things, and you know, you can just hear and feel the concussion. It's just like a blast that's close up, you know, like you threw a grenade or something out there. You'd get a little vibration from it, and the ground would shake a little bit. And they're shooting these things from miles away, and you're in a hole on top of a hill, and earth is shaking. And it's just, you know.
Were these effective as far as, you know, destroying enemy or destroying enemy morale?
It had to destroy enemy morale, because all of us were saying, you know, thank God they don't have this. Because, you know, us in our little bunkers, you've got to feel helpless. You know, that. You know, as one ground soldier for another, I feel a large amount of respect for the enemy soldiers over there, because, you know, I may have killed a bunch of them, but they shot my tail off a bunch of times too. And, you know, at that point, I don't know, like, you've just got to feel a little bit sorry for them. In war, you can't feel sorry for anybody. You cannot be that way. But now, you know, I'm sitting back here where it's comfortable and everything else like that, and you've just got to admire the courage of an old boy that would sit there in the face of all that stuff. If courage is what it is, or his fixation on his beliefs, because if he had a lick of sense when he saw those arc light bombings, you know, he should have come over to our side, because there's, you know, God, gee, if, you know, I don't see how anybody could live through something like that, you know, with that technology. That's why I can't believe that we didn't win that sucker. We should have just done that and continued. Started somewhere around Da Nang and stopped at North Vietnam.
By the way, a lot of people did surrender as a result of these. They had a tremendous effect on them.
I can see why, because they are, you know.
Well, because they were just terrifying, and it'd be completely silent, and then they would start, and then you didn't know whether it was going to come on you or, you know, where. Listen, the final thing, we've done everything, Bob, that I could ask of you today, and it's been almost 3 hours now, so we've really done a lot of work. Maybe some comments just on some of the recent films, like The Boys and Company B.
Is it Company B or Company C?
C.
Okay.
Yeah, Boys and Company C, which we were talking about just last night. Some of the guys had seen, they'd seen the movie on cable television, and I'd seen the movie when it played, because you know, I still am interested in how Vietnam is portrayed, because you've asked me a lot of questions and interviewed about, you know, things about Vietnam, but to give you my personal opinion of Vietnam, you know, this is what I'm looking for about it. You know, I don't like to be looked upon as a war criminal, and I don't like to be shunned because I was in, quote, an unpopular war, unquote. And because guys go to Canada and everybody in Jane Fonda now is saying, you know, hey, I'm right and everything. And by the way, to this day, I have not, will not, or shall never, until the day that I die, go see a Jane Fonda movie. But that's no disrespect for Father, because I think he's great. But to see Jane Fonda cavorting with the enemy, and at the time, I know that she probably caused problems for our POWs, and that's just she's just a very touchy subject with me. But these,
how about The Boys in Company C?
The Boys in Company C, that's a complete invalid misrepresentation of what Vietnam was. It was a, you know, it was a slap at the Marine Corps, I feel, personally. Beginning with, you know, boot camp, the instilling of discipline and morale and this and that, it's just not handled that way. And, you know, there are some parts that sometimes when a Marine Corps uses very a drill instructor in particular, because I was there, and you use very earthy language, you know, that part, yeah, that's okay. But Vietnam, as portrayed in The Boys in Company C, was nothing more than a doped-up soccer game to me. And this is how I came out of this movie feeling, is that this movie is about a misfit ragtag soccer team that is smoking dope, and they happen to be in a place where there's a war going on, you know. And, you know, they get into the hopeless situation of killing the little baseball-playing kid or something like that to hit home on some kind of a tragedy thing. Well, you know, for Christ's sake, they missed the whole concept of tragedy. If they wanted to depict tragedy, they should have been more realistic in their presentation of everything. You know, narcotics and stuff, narcotics as well as the soccer playing that they showed, that's not the way to bring it home.
Let me ask you this, Kaesong, were people on drugs?
No, not to my knowledge. I didn't see anybody on drugs. The only drugs that was at Kaesong was, after an old boy got shot up, they may have tagged him with morphine and loaded him on a helicopter and got him out of there.
Okay, what about Coming Home? Is this one of the films that you would refuse to see?
Yes.
Okay. I saw it. I hated it. With the Harry Gill, the Marine Corps. The Marine officer comes off as the worst,
really?
Kind of a psychopathic murderer. And I've had a student do a very long paper on it to kind of bring out this thing. So you've not seen it?
No.
Has anybody talked with you about it? Or?
No, because, you know, funny, and, you know, a lot of my friends are veterans from Vietnam, Army as well as Marine Corps and stuff like that. And they have the same opinion about Jane Fonda, personally. You know, as an actress, she may be great. She won an Oscar, and that proves that she's great. But, you know, as a human being, no, I won't go see anything that she does, and that's, you know, that's too bad.
Okay, what about The Deer Hunter?
I really felt that was a very depressing movie. You know, I left it, and it was kind of unreal. I mean, you know, I thought that the first part of it was like Animal House, where you got a bunch of buddies that are drunk and, you know, and college guys getting, you know, having a good time, and then all of a sudden you're in war for 15 seconds. You're in a POW camp for a very short time, and then you're back home worrying about the problems, and then you're back in Vietnam playing Russian roulette. And, you know, I'm sure this has got to be uneasy for the POWs and things. I don't think that it showed, for the sake of the POWs, anything like near what they really had to go through. And I don't think that for the sake of the people that were actually in Vietnam, that it didn't get close to anything that they had to go through. And for those reasons, you know, I think...
What specific thing, let's say, in terms of the, not so the POW aspect, but the just somebody who went over there and fought, what was the most unreal thing in The Deer Hunter?
In The Deer Hunter?
Yeah, that really irritated you.
Well, you know, I personally don't think, you know, like they showed the village scene of what was his name? The guy that starred in the movie Deer Hunter. Anyway, him. Yeah, Robert De Niro. Was it Robert or Peter De Niro? Robert. Okay. He's going through this village, and you know, and he's all shot up and everything, and then the big bad one communist soldier, he opens up the little bunker and tosses a grenade down in it and kills the family, you know. And that blip right there is supposed to tell everybody and show everybody that this guy is in war. That it does. It tells them, hey, you know, the guy is obviously fighting a battle or something like that. But, you know, the story is not about Vietnam because it didn't show that much of Vietnam. The story is about, you know, one guy that goes out of his gourd because of some the traumatic things that happened to him as a POW. And I think that they should have knocked out an awful lot of the wedding and what have you. Gone to what turned the old boy into, you know, a psychotic, you know, which is Vietnam. If they wanted to cover Vietnam, they'd cover Vietnam. If they wanted to cover the aspect of being a prisoner of war, then cover the aspect of being a prisoner of war.
It should be something I should ask you. Is there anything that I have left out? Now, you looked at the paper.
Yeah.
Of course, you haven't seen any. Maybe at some point I'll bring down some of the footage and, you know, not saying tomorrow, but, yeah. You know, sometime next fall or whatever. I've appreciated all that you've contributed, especially your time. And these have been very thoughtful replies and will be extremely useful to us.
Good, I hope so.
But is there anything that we left out that you know, you read the paper, you have a general idea of what we're after, anything that you were thinking about before we came down that didn't come up in conversation?
I don't know. There's got to be, but I, you know, well, I really can't think. I think your question is pretty well covered.
Well, I try to break them down by categories that, you know, general enough. You know, friendly, enemy, nature.
Mm-hmm.
Your case, wounds, and then when we got into them, then you work back out into other things which were on my mind, but I didn't have to ask because you got into them. But I thought the opening thing about the fog and the nature, that's excellent. And it's something I'd forgotten about and read about it, mm-hmm. but I hadn't, you know, just hadn't thought about it. How did you arrive there in the case? How did you get in? And you mentioned the caribou and so on. Maybe you could describe, right now I don't have anyone describing, what did it feel like to land there? And take off from there in the airfield. Maybe we'll end there.
Yeah, because that's something that surprised me too when it first happened. Was we were sent to Phu Bai by chopper, and you know, at that time, this is the first time I'd been to Phu Bai. Never heard of it. You know, I mean, I'd heard of it, but I'd never been there while I was in country. And you know, they flew us to Phu Bai to just the side of the corrugated steel landing strip. And we were offloaded off the choppers. They said, go over, you know, in the dirt, take your packs off, and sit down and wait a while because we're going to have a little wait. And we said, you know, where are we going? And you know, everybody's trying to find out what's going on. And then the word finally got passed down that we were going to a place called Kaesan, that there's a big enemy movement going on and that they were trying to get 175 cannons mounted up on Kaesan and blow up the Kaesan airstrip and everything, and the enemy was. And that we were going to go up there and that 1-9 had gotten annihilated, virtually. This is the word that was handed out to us. And, you know, at our pre-briefing, is that an outfit had gotten annihilated to the man, an American unit, and small unit though, and that we were going to go up there and recover them on the way to the mountains. Our objectives were 881 and 861. And all of a sudden here comes these big old KC-130s, and that was my first ride in one of those. And we loaded in there, and everybody's just, you know, standing on the bulkhead, standing on the deck, and laying down, sleeping and everything. And it wasn't a real long flight. But some guys could sleep aboard it, you know. We're hanging all over. I remember it was just jam-packed with people. They got as many as they could comfortably or uncomfortably. It didn't really matter. You just got on. And
that sucker goes rumbling down there, and coming into Quezon, I remember looking out the window. I'm always the kind of guy that sits by the window of the airplane, and I like to see where I'm going and everything. And I was looking out the window as we were approaching Quezon. I thought, you know, God, because I've been out west and I've seen the mountains, and I thought, hey guys, we're in the mountains now, and because we'd just come from the beaches and the lowlands, and again those clouds and the fogs and the rivers, and I saw Quezon River, and then they told us, you know, that we were at Quezon. So I think Quezon means blue river or something river. I had a Vietnamese friend that was here in the United States, and they told me that, I asked him what Quezon meant, which is something I'd be very interested in finding out what it means. I think it means some kind of a river. And I saw that river, and all of a sudden the aircraft, just the bottom dropped out of it, and we were going down to the landing strip. And that's how they had to make their approach, because, and we were forewarned of this by the crew chief aboard the aircraft. He said, now, you know, when we come in, he says, we're going to have to come in awful high, just drop straight down. He says, you know, so don't anybody panic, because, you know, he says, the airstrip is so close to the mountains that we're able to get a mortar in our tail, because they can pop them right up to you. And we came on in and landed and offloaded the sucker very quick. And In David Duncan's photographs, all of that wasn't there at that time. It wasn't that built up. And in the siege of Quezon and everything that everybody knows about, Quezon didn't appear like that when we first arrived. It was a corrugated steel runway laid down on the ground, and villagers' hooches, and some of the engineers' equipment that put the runway there. And from in the very short time that we left there and went up to the mountain and came back to down here, that place had changed. It just looked like a town that you would come back into after 50 years, from nothing but desert to hardbacks and Jesus, you know, virtually everything. And we started walking immediately after we got off the runway up towards 861. And I remember passing by some villagers. And that was our first time in and at Quezon.
So when you left, you were medevaced?
No, not from Quezon.
Okay, how did you describe leaving it, if you would? Or wasn't that very dramatic?
Yeah, to me it was.
Why don't you describe it, Wayne? Just,
After we had secured the mountain, that, or 881, which was our, after we took 861, we secured 881, I guess it was north, and we started to, we got the word that they were going to pull us off and out of there, because, you know, we had been there at the very beginning of the capture of 881 and 861. And so just as part of the plan, it was our turn to get off of the mountain and to be relieved, and another unit would, fresh troops would come in and take over for us, and we would go back and recuperate, which is really, you know, putting it mildly, what we had to do after that. And it's just amazing that one day you could be there seeing and chunking grenades, you know, being in a grenade battle one night and throwing a softball aboard the ship the next night. And our first night aboard the ship, we were sitting there watching a movie on the flight deck of the USS Ogden. And that day we'd gotten back from Quezon, and instead of, we were watching, what was the name of that movie? Haley Mills is some movie with Haley Mills. It's a dumb, stupid movie, but it was the only one that they had at the time, and they wanted to, you know, the Navy guys wanted to treat us right, and no one paid any attention to the movie. Everybody was really, you know, quiet. And, it, you know, it took a couple of days to get things back to the joking and stuff that was normal shipboard activity. I think the second day, everybody was their same crazy self again. But, you know, the initial capturing of Kaysan, to me, was something that, you know, since we came back, people said, they're going to make a movie about this someday. And I'm sure that everybody's surprised that, you know, that the Green Berets, John Wayne, was the only one that made a movie about it during that time. We felt like somebody was going to make a movie about Kaysan, you know, at that time, or during that period. Because, you know, even the old-timers, and I'm sure that you'll find this out when you talk to them, the guys that have been in the Korean War, maybe in World War II or something like that, they sensed that this was some kind of an operation that we were involved in there. And it was due in part largely to the combination of air support, ground support, naval gunfire, and the ground troops, the artillery.
Well, this is great, but specifically when you left Kaysan, how did you go out?
By
physically,
by chopper.
Okay, could you describe that just
briefly? We left 881 and went back to 881 South, I believe it was, or 861. And the choppers came in. They were the CH-47s. We loaded on them and went back down to Kaysan, and then we flew to. I think it was back to Fubai. And then from Fubai, we were picked up again by choppers and taken to our ships.
You didn't stop at the Kaysan base and unload and get onto 130s again. You were stayed in the helicopters, is that correct?
Yeah. You know, that's how we got down there, I think.
By helicopters.
I think that, I can't remember. To me, it seems like we just, once we got on the choppers there at Kaysan, we flew to the ships.
Well, that could happen.
I think that's the way we did it.
Okay. Well, Bob, this has been a lot of work on your part and a tremendous treat for me, if I may say so. Because I've been working on this project now for 2 years, including, I supported myself for one whole summer. 3 months working down in Washington, various archives, and digging up all these fragments that are, you know, buried in all sorts of places. And so it's a real treat for me to meet somebody who thinks as highly of the, you know, the overall importance of the subject as I do. And I appreciate the effort that you've given us too. And at some point, you know, we may, as I say, want to come back. And in fact, I know we're going to have to do something with those photographs, in terms of tape or something like that. So you'll be sure to see us and hear from us again.
Just whatever you need.
But this contribution is terrific, isn't it, Mitch? Now, Mitch has heard the interview.
Have you been with him on all of them?
Well, we haven't had that many live interviews on this particular film. You're really the first one.
Is that right?
For this film, yeah. And if I may say so, you did just as well as Will Rogers Jr. or the others. Well, it's something you see in this case that's very important to you. And
at 881, after we'd captured it, this was the day that the guy got his face shot off. Mm-hmm. That the corpsman that was working on me was was shot and killed. And we lost an awful lot of people. Golden, he was shot across the pelvis.
But the night stuff, of course, is so important.
Yeah, and everything settles down, you know. But then again, it doesn't. It just starts to intensify even more. And, it, you know, And at night, you know, night was such a threat there. You know, for a ground troop, I mean, you're down there on the ground with them. You know, the helicopters and the good guys and everything up above there, they can fly around and devastate the area, but then they leave. They got to go someplace. They have someplace they have to be. And you've got to be there with whatever there are out there. And we already knew that there were still a bunch of them. We were in our bunkers. We were using their bunkers as our bunkers. And inside our own perimeter, guys were digging bunkers and would find a North Vietnamese soldier down in there. North Vietnamese soldier, not DC. These are hardcore North Vietnamese, highly trained and highly equipped people. And, he's in there digging his old hole, and all of a sudden, the next thing you know, he was standing outside of his hole with his gun pointed back down in there, and he says, "Hey," he says, "Damn," he says, I've got a prisoner down here." And the guy comes out, and he's inside our perimeter. So then, everybody's, they're digging into their holes and stuff and checking their holes, and then, if there's a body in what you wanted to use as a bunker, you just move to another one or you dig a brand new one. And, and that night, you may be only feet away from, and have to stay feet away from a corpse. And the flies are all bad and everything. And then that fog would come up, and it, for a 19-year-old guy to be experiencing stuff like this, monster movies don't scare me now after that, because, Jesus, it's just...
What about these grenade chucking contests you were talking about?
Oh, man. I had a grenade that was thrown in my hole that I found. That's my souvenir that I've got now. And, the only reason I've got it as a souvenir, is because it didn't go off.
Oh, is that? I didn't quite get that. I figured that's what it was.
It would.
Why?
It's a trophy.
Yeah.
It's something that, thrown at him but did not go off.
Yeah, I thought it was a dirt clot at first from another explosion that had occurred, and it hit me in the shoulder on the flak jacket, and it just rolled down into the hole. And the fuse had burned just about this far from the blasting cap, and it didn't go off. When I disarmed the thing, I took it apart, and I clipped the cut the fuse off, and the blasting cap and everything was in good shape, and the fuse had just burned down so far, and apparently the powder that was in it was messed up. It's a Chi-Com, photograph of that one, Chi-Com grenade, and I've got it up in the attic someplace. And,
how about the when were the grenades used? You say at night, why at
night? Night and day. As in this picture you can see here, it was like, just like kids get into a dirt clod fight or, corn cob fight or something, they're chunking baseballs or something at each other. We were up there throwing, grenades at each other, and that was your most valuable commodity there for a while because, if you had a case of grenades at your hole, then you're in business. And it would be nothing to go through a case of grenades.
No. What else? If you had a case,
you'd have about a case per hole, and someone would start it, and it's just a very effective way of being in a firefight without giving away your exact position, because a gun or a machine gun leaves the flash, muzzle flash, and a grenade, you pull the pin, release the spoon, and throw it, and they don't know where, what position or direction it comes from, and then you've got a very large blast, and it'll knock out a bunch of folks. If you didn't have grenades, you'd throw rocks or dirt clods. They'd just hear the thud of the dirt clod, and it'd have them move from one area to another, and then you'd throw a live grenade, and you'd catch a bunch of people in a pocket. And they were effective, too. They used them towards us. But we were already in bunkers and in positions and relatively protected. We did have people that were hurt, injured, wounded, not very many killed. But, you know, it turned out to be a very effective tool for finding them that night. But, you know, we sure threw a bunch of them. Well, I mean to tell you, I remember chunking those things, just one right after the other, as soon as I could grab one. I bet I threw five grenades in less than 5 seconds, because you'd always take out what you think you would need for any given setting, because they'd come and they'd hit you, and then they'd fall back, and then they'd come again. So you take out, say, five or six over here, pull down the crimp pin on it so that you could, you know, you could pull it real quick, and then the rest of them, you'd leave the pins crimped on them so that it'd be harder to pull. And so you're messing around in the dark, so you've got to put everything where you can feel it, because after the first explosion goes off, you're blinded the same as he's blinded. When he throws a grenade at you and the flash goes off, you're blinded and you can't see. So it becomes a firefight with sound. You know, if you hear somebody, or you hear a wounded soldier down there, or you hear any Vietnamese being spoken or something, then that's the direction that you're going to throw the grenade in. And you just throw it towards the sound, because you're blinded. And you know, and I guess he does the same thing. Whenever you see a flash or something like that, you can see people down in there if it's far enough away. And if it's your grenade that causes the flash, you know that you'll be a safe distance. But 9 out of 10 times, you're, you know, just having to go with sound. So everything was set where you put it, where you could just stick your hands out and feel it. And then you knew that over here was another one. And then you knew that down here was your whole case, and they were still in the carton. And you pull the tape, or you had the tape, or where all you had to do is pull the top off of it, pull the grenade out, and then chuck it. And, you know, it's just like, you know, putting on your magazine. You tape two of them together so you can fire one up and switch it around and do it. Just little tricks that an old boy would make, instead of make work convenient for himself, it'd make, you know, war convenient for him.
Well, that's great stuff. It really is. Now, some of the cases you asked me about, you know, what I'd seen in Washington. One of the problems in trying to make a film about Vietnam, of course, is it's night business.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of Marine Corps combat art work in Washington, and I've gone through all that. And so we'll try to use, like, your description of night and other people's description, weave them together with some of this combat art. And some of it's excellent, including the grenades going off and pictures of the explosions and so on. And not only is the combat art good because it covers night topics, but of course any artwork done by hand reflects a human attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And here again, this is something that no one's seen. The whole resource of the war experience, which no one's taken any interest at all.
You mentioned earlier about, you know, night, the sounds of nighttime. And, while we were at 881, one of the first nights, you would have a normal listening post of, say, two guys. And there were three of us put on listening posts this one night, and we used an old spider trap, a sniper's spider trap that belonged to one of the enemy, that was on that saddle between 881 North and 881 South. We were outside the perimeter, and this was the, you know, while we ca- after we had captured the 881, the hill. And being outside of your own perimeter after, you know, just after you'd fought that to gain the objective, and knowing that all of your support and everything is back there, it just really makes you feel all alone. And I remember at nighttime, you know, and you're so tired. We were so tired because, you know, the climb up there, and you know, you're given time to sleep, and you sleep 50% or whatever, and you wake up just like that. Or any sight, any sound, any smell that is different at night, no matter what, you wake up. You can hear a clicking noise for a. You can sense it. You can smell it a mile away if something clicks. But I remember we were in the hole that night at Kaysum on an LP, which is a, you know, they're telling you to go out there and listen, because sound is one of, you know, is the most distinctive sensing device in the jungle that you'd have. And you've got to differentiate all of these different sounds, all the jungle noises. The jungle is noisy at nighttime too, believe me. But it's, you know, you're always straining, and then you always imagine things too. You're hearing noises, and then all of a sudden in your mind you're visualizing a platoon crawling on its belly with its weapons and things up right.